Welcome to Dr. E, a Monday evening program that is part of Focus on Community. This once-a-month radio show is dedicated to informing Southeast Alaska K2 listeners about a myriad of psychological and social issues confronting us in our daily lives, and, ultimately, about living our lives with more awareness and greater happiness. I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder, and with me in the studio this evening is Nancy Seamont, a beloved counselor and educator in the Juno school system who has positively influenced the lives of hundreds of Juno students and their families, and I must admit, including my own. Imagine that you're the parent of a teenager, and you've begun to lose sleep at night because suddenly your previously delightful daughter is defying you, and her grades are slipping drastically towards D's and F's. What do you do? Where do you go? Well, I can tell you, as a therapist, I know where many worried parents went, straight to Nancy Seamont at Juno Douglas High School. So I invited Nancy Seamont on my program tonight because she has observed and skillfully intervened in the lives of so many of our community teens. But even beyond that, Nancy has a perspective on our educational system that is both piercing and well-informed. Welcome to Dr. E, Nancy.
Well, that was a very kind introduction.
And let me tell you, I could have made it more overblown and still have been honest. But for those few listeners who've never heard of Nancy Seamont, I didn't want to overdo it.
Please.
Okay.
Please.
And congratulations on your recent retirement, because I think that I would not have dared ask you on the show if you were still working full time. So welcome. And you did recently retire. How long ago?
I retired last June from you know, the district. However, I am working with a fantastic credit recovery program called CARES, and I work 7 to 14 hours a week.
And what is CARES about?
CARES, now let's see, I don't know how many listeners have the knowledge of the Bible, but, and I'm not talking religion here, don't worry, Dr. E, but it is likened to the story of the lost sheep, where Jesus goes out to find that sheep that is stuck on the mountain crevice. So what we do is we track down, and it's very rewarding because as a teacher with, you know, my class sizes were up to 40 at one point. It was very often a tragic personal sorrow when we, you know, I lost kids all the time. They disappeared, and we'd try to call them from the classroom, and we'd send people out for them. However, at times they could not be found. But what is wonderful about CARES is that is my job. I seek down the kids who have failed a class or many classes and are in danger of graduating, and I'm able to capture them and invite them into this most amazing program, which is able, through a grant, through a 21st century grant, to do what we'd like to do during the day. We have small classes, 1 to 10. We are surrounded. They're surrounded by positive mentors. We have AmeriCorps, who are fantastic. Everybody who's hired is somebody who has the ability to have relationships with kids. So we get those kids. All I have to do is find them and bring them over and get them set up in the program. And it is incredibly rewarding to see those kids come after school and stay. We have 70% of our kids who start stay, which is a lot. Stay and finish their classes because it's after school.
How do you find them?
Many ways. The counselors at Juno Douglas High School are phenomenal. We recently had a counselor cut back, yet they continue to go for it for all kids. They help identify kids who have failed a class or have failed many classes, especially those kids who are in danger of not graduating. Teachers refer, parents refer. Some of our staff, our AmeriCorps, does computer searches to find kids who have failed classes. There are many, many ways.
Okay. Okay. Now, tell me what you've been doing for the last couple of decades at Juno Douglas High School. I know you have taught health classes, but let's even go deeper than that, like Students for Social Responsibility. Give me some of your background.
Okay.
A recent background at Juneau Douglas High School.
Well, if I could just be slightly defiant like my kids, let me just say the prelude to coming to Juneau Douglas High School, because it relates so much.
Yeah, what were you doing before
you
came?
Well, I did 5 years as an elementary counselor here in town. And yeah, and so I came from a family that was imperfect but very connected, you know, through education, wilderness, spirituality.
Your own family of origin.
Yes, my own family of origin.
Very connected.
Very connected and very close.
Very close.
So I had quite a community, and we were kind of a place where other kids went because there was quite the community going on there. And so I started working in our elementary schools, and I have to say I was completely overwhelmed by the issues that our kids are facing. And this is in the 80s. By the time they were fifth graders and I had gotten to know everybody, I knew that a fourth at that point had gone through a divorce. A half of the population had gone through a divorce with their parents.
Mm-hmm.
A fourth had had some sort of violence in the home. Another fourth had some sort of drug and alcohol in the home. And another fourth had faced some sort of sexual abuse, sexual boundary crossing that I knew of. And these were great kids, and these were great parents. These were people that were struggling with the situations at hand, with single parenting, with poverty, with what's happened as a result of rapid social change. And you're a sociologist, Dr. E. So
I'm not a sociologist. I'm a psychotherapist, but go on.
But yes, but you have that background. I know you have that background.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I know that you know how we as a society are having a very hard time keeping up with those rapid rates of change. And because of that, our families are disintegrating in lots of ways. So there are no bad people out there, in my opinion, but the kids were feeling a lot of suffering. So I got to go from elementary school, where I knew these kids, and I got to meet them again in high school.
Ah.
And when I made the transition, I told myself I would never forget that there was a little kid in every big kid.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually in every adult.
Mm-hmm.
So when I came to the high school, I felt like I had a secret. I had a secret that no matter how these kids were acting, I could imagine, or I knew personally, what their lives were like when they were six. It doesn't mean I would enable, but it meant that I had tremendous compassion for kids and their
understanding
families.
Understanding that means you don't get mad at them.
No,
because
there was no anger.
It
wasn't personal at all.
No, it's simple to look at the symptoms of a kid, for example, the defiant kid, and get real angry.
Yes, when they told me to, F off, there was no problem. I mean, of course, they had to be disciplined, but it was nothing personal.
Yeah.
I knew that they had tremendous stress going on in their lives. So when I got to teach the last 21 years at the high school, I think that the gift that I got from the elementary years was that sense of tremendous compassion for the kids and not personalizing.
Mm-hmm.
So I can talk a lot about that, but I don't want to go into details that aren't interesting. I would like to say that it was a tremendous privilege. I live above the high school. I would walk down every day with tremendous excitement because I feel that our kids in Juneau are amazing. They are lovable. They have humor. They've spent a lot of time outdoors, sometimes not enough. But every day was a gift. I'd walk down that hill, and I would be so excited. And sometimes I would say to myself, boy, you don't feel very good. And I'd say, I wonder how you're going to feel when you walk in that room. And when I walked in that room, I felt so happy. Having a classroom is a wonderful thing because you can create a culture. You can be the boss and establish the rules. And my culture was one where I did my best to promote compassion, empathy, and not allow bullying. Bullies would have to drop the class and come back later when they had matured, but we would work with them a lot before that. So it was a tremendous experience just having a safe place for me and for all my students.
Well, I remember years ago when you asked me to help you develop a curriculum to fight homophobia.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an AIDS curriculum. And I think we were some of the first people to bring in gay speakers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we did.
Gay speakers. And to this day, the speaker we brought in is still, she published a book. She goes around and works on human rights for homosexual and lesbian people. And it was the beginning, and I think it was pretty radical in at that time. Because that must have been maybe 15 years ago, at least.
No, 20.
20 years ago. It was a long, long time ago. But you've had a lot of innovative curriculum work. You've done a lot of work. And I know you worked for years with the group that you founded called, was it Students for Social Responsibility?
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about that.
Okay. Let me go back for a minute to the working with the kids and homophobia. One of the things I felt strongly about was respecting families and respecting their differences. So in terms of working with that issue, we were very clear that this was not about whether or not you felt the gay lifestyle was a moral issue, you know, or immoral, but it was about how we treat other people and that our gay students are at such high risk, you know, for depression and suicide that it's a critical safety issue. But we worked very hard to respect the opinions of our families. Mm-hmm. And so I just wanted to mention that. So Students for Social Responsibility, my partner at work, counselor Kelly Hobson, and I put together the program, and it was a collaboration of many agencies, and that was something I deeply believe in to this day, that collaborations rock. We have amazing nonprofits in this town that work together like I've never seen. It was a collaboration of us, the National Council on Alcoholism, and sometimes different groups like Big Brothers and Sisters, SAGA, AWARE. Actually, many, many, many agencies were involved, and they were wonderful. What it was I taught a class. It was a student leadership class, and they were trained in very specific skills along with kind of a global education, you know, empathy training. And the skills were peer mediation, peer leadership, small group facilitation. And so those kids then did different things. They all had to help lead a service project that was a partner with an agency. So we'd worked out a real need that existed in the community. And then those service projects were offered to my health kids, and I had about 400 a year at the time. And so then.
And let's mention that Nancy taught health education.
Oh, I'm sorry.
At the high school for decades. Go on.
Okay, so then those kids would lead those service projects along with the agency partners, and they also would become the student leaders or the student teachers in my health classes, because the research was very clear in health education that kids learn the best from each other.
So they'd be like TAs.
They would be TAs, but more than just a TA, not Xeroxing papers, but they were trained to be teachers, and they would assist in facilitating the activities. I like to keep my class moving, so there were a lot of activities. You know, I primarily did the lectures, and they primarily facilitated the activities. So it was my lectures a third. The kids couldn't take more than 20 minutes of me. I thought it was funny, but anyway, I think kids in general don't like more than 20 minutes of a lecture at a time, you know, before we do projects or activities. Mm-hmm. So that my student teachers would facilitate those. We had a network with the Choice Program, which is a program for our kids who have not been successful in the regular school day. And they are a school within a school, and they have a retreat program that I helped develop a year I had a Krista McAuliffe Fellowship, and it was a series of 5 retreats.
You had a Krista McAuliffe Fellowship.
At the time, I think it's become something else, but at the time, one teacher a year got this fellowship. So they were essentially paid to do something aside from the regular duties. They would
one
make
teacher a year from the state?
From the state.
Oh,
so
congratulations.
Each state got one. So I got to do this one where I got to take our peer leadership or our peer helping program and transform it into Students for Social Responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of that was developing these 5 retreats. There's something about retreats that are amazing. We did them at Chapel by the Lake, which is one of the most amazing churches. I mean, we had so many kids running through that building, and that population, those parishioners were so patient with us. Anyway, very transformative for the kids, and our students led the small group that happened at the retreat, the family groups. So it was a very exciting program. In 1999, four schools nationally were recognized as having significantly reduced their drug and alcohol use and violence. And it was after an extensive site visit and extensive documentation, and we were one of those four schools.
Wow. Mm-hmm. And was it attributed to this program?
Yes, and the work with Ron Gleason, who was definitely involved. You know, he was an outstanding leader. And so, yes, it was this program. And I would say along with Ron, because leadership is everything. Mm-hmm. Leadership from the top. You can't do anything very mm-hmm. well, very completely without leadership from the top.
Yeah. Now, you've been trained as a psychologist, but you're an educator as well.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have a bachelor's and master's degree?
I have a master's in counseling, but
okay.
I will be honest, it was really painful to be an elementary counselor because of the suffering of children. One time I sat by somebody on an airplane, and the poor guy, he kept trying to talk to me, and I was tired. I didn't want to talk to him. And finally he goes, "So what do you do for a living?" And I said, "Oh, well, I'm an elementary school counselor." And the poor man says, what do you do? And he says, "I'm a school superintendent." Now he's long gone, someplace in Southeast. Anyway, so when I said I was an elementary school counselor, he said to me, "Well, you must play a lot of volleyball." It was so unfortunate for that man. He had a lecture for at least 45 minutes. I could not stop. I said, "Well, you obviously don't know your constituents very well." And I went on and on, and the man just crumbled into a little ball. It was like, when will we land now? But I was just so appalled that this man did not understand what children were facing, children and their families. So, yes, my background is in counseling. That period was... I finally said, you know, this is so painful. I would like to teach health because I also have a bachelor's in physical education and ergonomics. So I'd like to teach health and have more play and more fun. So,
well,
yes.
You did some. Did you do your work with National Council on Alcoholism before or after graduate school? How did that work out?
That was after graduate school.
Okay.
It was the first job I had in town.
In Juneau?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I was hired.
With Matt Felix?
I was hired over the vegetables. We were in Foodland, and I had actually, or A&P Foodland, whatever it is, had decided, I wasn't going to counsel right away. Let's have fun. Because, you know, I'd gone straight through college and, you know, paid most of it, and it was pretty rugged. So, but Matt, they were desperate. People were running to the pipeline every second. He couldn't hold on to anybody. And so we started talking over the vegetables, and he said, I have a provincial job. I'm like, I really don't want that. And he said, why don't you come for an interview? And so I very reluctantly came to an interview, and I made sure that I was dripping wet. I had just run through the rain, and I shook his hand, and, you know, water was dripping off of it. And I was trying to not get the job.
And there but for fate.
There but for fate. They needed a prevention specialist. But to tell you the truth, that's when I got to start working with the Juneau District, and I just loved it. And I loved the kids, and I loved the staff.
Well, it's a wonderful background. What you're dealing with, drugs and alcohol abuse aren't the only problems in high school, but... that's one of them, and having that hands-on experience, that's wonderful.
Well, the biggest thing was I realized how essential our nonprofits are. And that set the stage for me to always, always do whatever I did. I always had a partner, an agency partner.
Mm-hmm.
The collaborative, it set the stage for me to realize the school was just this little box in the midst of a huge community. So it opened my eyes. It was a great way to start.
Wonderful. Nancy? You and I have had long talks over the years about your philosophy of education.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things, you've been a teacher or a school counselor for 25, 30 years? How long have you been?
Over 30.
Over 30
yes.
years. And I find it, there's been so much social change and so much educational change and so much legislative change. Let's start with something you've always impressed me with, which is your deep structure knowledge that education is about relationship. Can you tell me a little bit what you mean
about
that.
Yes, well, study after study has shown that kids learn best in relationship. Now, some people say, wow, when I was a kid, I hated all my teachers. I didn't have any relationships. Mm. Well, society has changed so much. People, I've heard this said before, and it's so true. You know, when I went to school, I went to Catholic school. It was very structured. I didn't have any relationships with, there were two teachers I did.
Huh.
And I learned. But we were what we call dogs. We just were trying to please. And there was a boss there.
Oh, you're
like
dogs.
We were like dogs. Yeah, yeah, pleasing.
Pleasing.
And today's kids, for many, many reasons, are like cats. They don't trust automatically.
They're wary.
They're leery. We need to form relationships with them. I know it sounds negative, but that's just how it is. We need to form relationships.
I would assume, since human beings, their brains or the brains at birth may not have haven't changed. Therefore, there's some societal changes going on that is turning kids from wanting to please to wary.
Wary and mistrust. And, you know, we've had our families have suffered so much. You know, they're so, for all the reasons that, you know, I've referred to in the past and you have, you know, with there's so much change in families, again, related to this rapid rate of social change, kids see the government different. You know, we went through all that exposure of, you know, ever since Watergate, you know, there's been a mistrust of institutions.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a lot of reasons why I think we have cats and not dogs now.
Okay.
So it is critical. The research says over and over again that we must have relationships with our kids.
How can teachers have a relationship with the kids if they've got 40 kids? I mean, does class size affect that? I mean, that...
Well, obviously.
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 So you have relationship. How does the No Child Left Behind legislation, teaching to the test, grading teachers, how does that impact the quality of education,
mm-hmm.
in your opinion?
Well, I certainly, as a teacher, don't mind being graded.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's appropriate for us to get evaluated by, you know, our teachers and our parents.
And you always have been evaluated. I mean, that.
Yeah, but we could do more with that. And I think what we're really doing around teacher evaluation are the professional learning communities. Why kids get out early every other week is because our superintendent, you know, and most of us believe that when teachers get together and share their work and share their student work and, you know, backtrack and talk about how they taught and get ideas from each other, you know, we are developing ourselves as professionals. You know, there's been a lot of tragedy that's happening around teaching to the test. It doesn't encourage good instruction.
Mm-hmm.
Rote memorization is something that is not what we need in our 21st century. We need people that are complex thinkers, that are problem solvers. If we want to keep our place in the world, there's nothing that says we need to know how to remember dates and this and that and
mm-hmm.
This linear type instruction. Most of us feel just pretty sad about it, to be honest.
About the No Child Left Behind.
Yeah, the name is so deceitful because really it alienates kids so much.
It's just, you mean it's the opposite?
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm.
And Nancy, you brought some music today and have suggested some music. And I was wondering, when would be an appropriate time to play the first song? Would it be now? Or
let me talk a little bit about the song, because I want to dedicate it to some people. And it has to do with my compassion for the modern family. Again, it's just a tough time to be a family, to stay together as a family. Many of us are all of a sudden finding ourselves as step parents or single parents. So, I've been very fortunate in my life. And, I got together with my husband, years ago when my two stepkids were, 3 and 5. And they are just beautiful kids. But I was at the time, again, so overwhelmed with how it is for families and how hard it is. Before I got together with him, I went and talked to his ex-wife and basically asked permission. I said, well, would you mind if I got involved? Are you sure this relationship is over? I know this is over the top, but I might as well just It's an interesting story.
No, I think it's a very illustrative story of how to do it right.
Well, not everybody can do that. I just happen to know her, mm-hmm. and it was appropriate. You know, it would be very inappropriate in a lot of situations. And so she was wonderful. This is Terry Tibbett. She was wonderful, and she said, well, it's hard, but if I have to co-parent with somebody, you'd be good. And so we started out on the right foot, and this is so hard to let your kid have another parent, you know, because a step-parent thing can go two different directions. But she was always able to see that another parent in the picture could only benefit the kids. So she mm-hmm. always allowed me to be another mother, mm-hmm. you know, share the mothering.
Mm-hmm.
And so what that did was that allowed me to share my entire family. And I have lots of wonderful nieces and nephews mm-hmm. that were the same age as my stepkids.
Mm-hmm.
So along the path as well, I adopted a child from China, my mm-hmm. daughter Rose, and it came time for her baptism, so we went to Santa Cruz to have a baptism ceremony. But something was bugging me. You know, she was going to have this baptism. The whole family was going to be there. But my family had really fallen in love with Alex and Haley, my stepkids. And I just said, we've got to expand this. So we had a baptism one day, and then the next day we had a formal adoption ceremony of my two stepchildren, and my entire family gathered, and it was a beautiful ceremony performed by Linda Buckley on the lawn, some lawn in Santa Cruz, and my family formally adopted them, and Pastor Rose and told them individually why they were so happy to have them in the family. So I have a song here on adoption, and I just wanted to dedicate it to Rose and Alex and Haley and to their mother, who mm-hmm. allowed me to expand their lives.
Thank you, Nancy. And let's do it.
And it's here's to you and three cheers to you. Let's shout it, hip, 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 hooray. For out of a world so tattered and torn, you came to our house on that wonderful morn. And all of a sudden, this family was born. Oh, happy adoption. There are those who think families happen by chance, a mystery their whole life through. But we had a voice, and we had a choice. We were working and waiting for you. And it's here's to you and three cheers to you. Let's shout it, hip, 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 hooray. For our tattered and torn, you came to our house on that wonderful morn. And all of a sudden, this family was born. Oh, happy adoption day. And it's here to you and three cheers to you. Let's
Welcome back to Dr. E. I'm Elaine Schroeder, and in the studio with me is Nancy Seamont, a well-known and well-loved educator and counselor, formerly at the Downtown High School, and currently still part-time with the Juneau School District. We are having a conversation tonight about the lives of teenagers in Juneau, the challenges their parents face, and most recently we've been talking about the educational system. And let me ask Nancy about, we were just a moment ago talking about the act No Child Left Behind, and the whole anti-intellectual stance that I perceive in the U.S. and really negative attitudes, the latest volley of negative stuff from conservative political groups about teachers. How did you react to that and this, the whole issue, the anti-intellectual bent?
Well, if it gets any traction, it scares me a lot. When you look at the last century, the three most tragic, well, if you take the Holocaust out, the three most tragic countries that tortured their own were countries that were following an anti-intellectual model. They attacked the intellectuals, and that is the Soviet Union. One out of four people were killed by the government through their methods. China, it had another about one out
revolution.
Of four. Well, before that, it had famine, tremendous famine, because Mao went after the intellectuals very specifically. And, you know, disbanded the farming methods and, you know, institutionalized. It's like the No Child Left Behind. Somebody wasn't a farmer, says this is how we're going to do it. So the people literally starved to death. And in Cambodia, Pol Pot, both those three countries went after the intellectuals to gain power.
Yeah.
And with tremendous cost of life, you know, a quarter of their populations, you know, killed. And specifically targeting intellectuals. So the anti-intellectual movement frightens me a lot. So I...
How does that relate, do you think, to the attack on teachers?
Well, I think it's part of it. You know, you know, would you have a surgeon, would you pick up somebody off the street and have them be a surgeon? No. I mean, teaching is a skill and an art. I mean, it's a love. I love it. But it is such a skill that the techniques of learning have been studied, you know, have been studied over and over again. So we, you know, a good teacher knows what they're doing, and if you want to,
and
it's highly educated, and if you want to go watch it, you need to watch it. Go watch it. You know, go in the classrooms. It's part of our problem is we don't have enough people in there with us to see what we're doing.
I've lived in Europe for a couple of years, and specifically in France. But I was just reading an article about comparing the Finnish education system with the U.S. education system. And Finland has far better results than we do, far, on teaching outcomes. And one of the major factors that is the causal factor that the research has found is the status and educational background of teachers. Teachers have a very high status in Finland. They're paid well, and they have to have master's degrees, and that's part of why they're paid well. And it's a highly respected profession that the best of the best want to go into. Is that happening in the U.S.?
Well, it's not happening in Juneau. Our teachers, especially the incoming ones, are barely above poverty level. They can't, with a master's degree, you know, what are they, start at mid-30s? It's a tragedy. We're having very few applicants for our positions, teachers and administrators. We're probably, let's see, in terms of pay, we may be fifth in the nation, but when you consider cost of living, we're 20th, around 20th. And again, there's this whole moving to Alaska. We're a difficult place. So we are not attracting talent. I'm not saying our current staff or, you know, are not talented, but we don't have large numbers of applicants for our positions.
And is it because of salaries or?
Oh, salaries, yeah. Our salaries have really diminished over the years.
And that has to do with decreased funding for education. And there is a lot of controversy about that right now, funding of Alaska school system. And I there was a negative remark. I can't fund a failing system by a politician.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think of that?
Well, it's stunning to me, absolutely stunning.
I can't fund a failing system.
I could make an analogy to that.
Uh-huh.
If you had a child standing in the cold and they needed a jacket and you stood there and said, oh, well, I don't like the jackets that are being made right now, so I'm sorry, but we can't give you a jacket, so you go stand there, dude.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that statement to me is an outrage.
Well, I can't fund a failing system. They're talking about the educational system.
Oh.
First of all, the notion of why it is failing. One of the reasons that I have gleaned from the research on education outcomes,
mm-hmm,
is the level of poverty in the United States.
Absolutely.
In American history, since before the Depression, there has never been such a concentration of wealth in the United States. And if there's a concentration of wealth, that means there's a lot of poverty. And poverty is the biggest predictor of poor school performance.
That's
so
absolutely right.
I can't fund a failing system, educational system, is it certainly an oxymoron, because obviously what you need is more funding for the educational system.
We have math classes that are 40 kids in a math class. We have, you know, of course, our kids suffer a lot of depression. We've gone through, you know, a lot of suicides that are completely tragic. And we are cutting our counselors. Our counselors have caseloads of 400 kids. We have a teen health center. I'm very grateful for that. But 80% of what they do is mental health.
Mm-hmm.
And we are cutting our counselors, and we're having math classes that size.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look, I consider school funding an issue of national security.
And how do you mean that?
You look at our place in the world, and everybody's talking about it, but we're dropping. When you look at the success of our students and the amount that are going to college and completing college, we are dropping compared to the rising countries of India and China. So it's national security. If we don't fund education, we are losing our base for competition, especially in sciences and math.
Mm-hmm. And one thing we're probably lucky in Juneau is that we don't have competition from the private sector in terms of the wealthy people in Juneau or the upper middle class sending their kids to private schools, because that is happening in the lower 48 as you start pulling out the more affluent families out of the schools. What happens?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have to care about society as a whole. Not, I mean, it's easy to say, well, my kids are going to be okay, but your kids are going to interact with the state of the country.
Yes.
And if our mass of population is dropping in their intelligence, and their, not their intelligence, but their performance and education, we're all going to suffer. So every kid is going to suffer.
How have you observed the environment? You said you've been in the schools for 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
The environment of the schools, just the feel of being a student, how have things changed in your view?
The feel of being a student, let me see. I can tell you the feel of staff is they're very discouraged.
Yeah.
They're very discouraged. And the staff are so good at trying to keep that from the kids, you know. So many things have gone well for kids as we've tried to personalize things so much more. You know, the two schools, you know, schools are smaller. We know the kids better. They're not getting as lost.
Do you think that's an improvement, the two schools?
Absolutely. Well, I have very mixed feelings, but in terms of the kids being known, it's a much better situation. Mm-hmm. You know, the privatization, there's so much awareness about the value of relationship, and there's been so much effort. So I think in terms of that and catching the lost sheep, there's been such a commitment to that and looking at our data and trying to follow our data. There's been so much work that's been done that is really right on. And so I think we're having tremendous successes that way. In terms of staff morale, with our budget forecast, it's very discouraging. I personally had a teacher friend who was young and had taught here 6 years, was a math teacher. There was no way she could buy even a condo. I mean, she had come up as a Jesuit volunteer and so knew how to live, you know, with a lot of austerity. And, you know, finally I said, you know what, you could be an engineer. Why don't you think about that? And she left.
You mean an engineer with a BA?
You could make money. Yeah, you could make money.
Yeah.
She, you know, had her teaching certificate in math, and she was fantastic. She mm-hmm. worked with our choice kids.
But this is a real case example.
A real case of somebody who just, in other words, our morale, it's tough. I mean, it's really tough. We shield the kids, so I think kids are doing, you know, feeling okay and feeling, you know, known, but I think the staff morale, I think we're going to see a lot of attrition by
mm-hmm.
choice
mm-hmm. okay.
in the other professions.
Yes. Nancy, you have been not only a teacher, but even in your role as a educator, you've been a counselor, because I know this. I know parents have come to you.
Mm-hmm.
And what are your observations? What do you think are some of the important issues around that are really challenging to parents today?
Well, first of all, I don't think the way we've set up schools in the last 100 years to me is a problem. You know, that we get kids in same age groups, 30 kids to one adult.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 100 years ago, kids were being brought into the bosom of the adult community by 14, learning a real skill, working mm-hmm. alongside an adult in a close mm-hmm. mentoring relationship. Yes, they need to individuate and separate themselves, but we accept far too much individuation,
mm-hmm.
far too much of, you know, the kids, you know, pushing back from us and living in their own little gangs.
Yes.
So I think
peers don't raise kids.
No,
I mean,
no,
kids
no.
Don't raise kids.
We have peers raising kids, and as parents, we just feel like, you know, they're drifting away at sea a lot.
Yeah. Well, this is part of the hurried child problem,
yes.
which is this is what I noticed. There's actually a book by Daniel Elkind called The Hurried Child. He's a child psychologist, and this came out about 10 years ago or 15 years ago, but it has accelerated, and it's the notion that a child's success is defined very much by their what they do rather than who they are. In this sense, putting children in such a high number of activities that the family is running around like mad, never sits down to the family dinner table, because every kid has a different schedule that evening in another activity. Now, this is a little tough because parents read, and I think it's correct, children who are involved in activities in school are more successful kids. But it's about balance. So you were talking about how much time kids spend with adults.
Yes,
compared to hanging out. If you have a teen activity, it's even a sports team,
mm-hmm.
it's likely to be one adult for 20 kids.
Right, right.
And so the kids are really with other kids.
Yes, and they need real-life roles, all this hanging. Yeah, so you bring it up, it's a complicated issue because they need to be doing real-life responsibilities, which is why service work has such positive results. It even prevents teen pregnancy.
Well, I remember you always had a service requirement, and
mm-hmm.
my daughter volunteered at the Gaston Humane Society. And what was brilliant about that is she was among adults.
Exactly.
As animals.
Exactly.
Her service work put her in touch with other adults, and these adults loved animals, and it was just perfect for her.
Exactly,
that's the service activity puts kids in with other adults rather than in a whole group of other kids.
Yes, yes. So I think as parents, you know, we're challenged. We need to invite more people into our kids' lives, you know, safe people, of course. We have to use discernment mm-hmm. and look for those opportunities. Single parents have a whole different challenge. I mean, they cry. I had a single mother crying with me a couple of weeks ago because her son, she basically works two or three jobs. She is not able to raise her son, and he's such a sweet kid, but this mm-hmm. kid cannot get it together, and she cries because she can't be there. So there's a whole other issue there that comes along with poverty where parents just can't even be with their kids or help them structure time. So then we have all this unstructured time where they're just basically doing useless things or being in front of screens. The average kid from 8 to 18 spends 6.5 hours a day in front of a screen. Now, I am a huge proponent of digital learning. We need that in our classrooms. But there is no reason to have a kid on their own spend 6.5 hours in front of a screen.
And you mean a computer screen,
yes.
A TV screen, an iPhone screen,
mm-hmm.
all these screens.
And missing all kinds of things like human interaction, creative play, being outdoors. The wilderness, it consistently has been shown in studies that study it, that it's extremely therapeutic for kids, does stress reduction. When you take kids into, you know, adolescent treatment for drugs and alcohol, the wilderness component is the most important component. So we're sitting around in our wilderness here, and we have our kids on screens. Not that we, you know, wanted them, but that's a lot of what's happening, too. So
when
I think parents have a lot of challenge.
When I led a group for high-risk girls at the middle school, at the end of the 8-week counseling program, we did a once-a-week counseling program for girls who were most at risk, I would take them on a picnic. And the picnic, of course, was at one of our wonderful beachside parks or somewhere in the out-of-doors. And what really stunned me was how few of these girls had ever been at these prime locations like Auk Rec, mm-hmm. Sandy Beach. They had never been to any of these very accessible outdoor places, let alone hiked or skied or were ever in the out of doors. So right then and there, I realized that the lack of that, and of course, when there's a lack of that today, it usually means more screen time. What are the kids doing? And recent neuroscience research has shown that it really changes kids' brains
mm-hmm.
and changes brains in ways that probably won't change back and is hypothesized to increase attention deficit disorder, to increase antisocial behaviors, lack of social skills. I work with a lot of teenagers, and I find that they are loath to talk on the telephone
mm-hmm.
because they're so used to texting. And so even the art of conversation becomes a lost art.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I just want to be clear. These tools are wonderful in the classroom because they're in the workplace, and we
right.
need to transform education, in my opinion, so that we are, we're a digital learning institution. But, you know, left alone, just messing around, it's really a complete dump of time.
And what should parents do?
Well, they're trying to figure it out. Because
yeah.
parents are aware of this very much.
Yeah.
And we're all trying to figure it out.
It's so fast. Everything is occurring so rapidly.
Exactly.
A
the rapid rate of change.
Mm-hmm. Of preteen kids go to sleep with their cell phones on.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one thing parents can do, which is to make sure their kid doesn't have a cell phone in their bedroom or a computer screen.
Oh, of course, lock them up if you can.
Right.
And so
basically, mm-hmm. and you and I have talked about this, you're recommending much more parent authority and intervention in the use of screen and the amount of time a kid spends on digital materials.
But all this is based on relationship. If we go at it top down, we have to do that sometimes. But what is really critical is that, and it goes back to what you said, what kind of time, what kind of connection are we making with our kid? If we're driving them from event to event, maybe there's a little connection in the car, but we have to stay connected to our kid so that these sorts of limits that we set they are interpreted as something that we are doing because we genuinely love them. Mm-hmm. So our attention, I think that's one thing that's a challenge for parents, you know, to have real attention for their kids, to laugh at their jokes. I always ask myself, yeah. Have I laughed at my kids' jokes this week? If I have not, mm-hmm. I haven't been there. Because kids are very funny,
yeah,
and you have to let some things go sometimes and to build that relationship. Anyway, yes, so I think the relationship with the kid is very important as we set boundaries. They must have boundaries, and they must be able to talk about how angry they are about these boundaries, and we listen. We have to listen to them. I think if we just slam things on them and don't listen, you know, it pulls us apart. But if we're listening to their anger and their rage at some sort of ridiculous, I mean, what I would call, oh my gosh, I can't believe you're so angry about this. But I believe we have to listen, let them get it out, and you know, keep our boundary, but we have to stay connected.
Okay. And Nancy, you have brought in one other song that is important to you and your family. And I want to make sure we don't run out of time and we have a chance to play it. So could you explain that?
Yeah. Okay. The song is about upward mobility. I feel very strongly that we need to keep our upward mobility in our country. It's about my own, it's dedicated to my own parents and to the GI Bill. Okay. My father grew up in a tent. He was a migrant farm worker. But he was also a benefit. He benefited from the GI Bill. And as an adult, then he was an agricultural engineer for the University of California. So we did spend, because he grew up in a tent, we spent a tremendous amount of time in the wilderness because he was so passionately in love with the wilderness, and that's why I'm here. I'm passionately in love with the wilderness. I think it's one of the prime reasons that we were so connected as a family. So
you did things in the outdoors.
We did things outside,
and
like
how
crazy,
and how lucky we are here
and
in Juneau.
We are so fortunate to have the resource. So anyway, my parents had their 50th wedding anniversary. Unfortunately, I wasn't there. I was in China getting my daughter Rose. But we made a slideshow, and this is a song that we played in their honor. So I wanted to play it in the honor of my own family. And every family in Juneau, I love our families, and I see the struggles, and I have compassion. So I wanted to dedicate this song to my parents and to all our families.
Thank you.
This tiny with the roof above, these four thin walls hold the ones I love. My mom and dad, all the kids and me. This tiny house is my family. This neighborhood, up and down our street, everyone I know, everyone I meet, from the oldest ones to the newest baby, this neighborhood is my family. Everything above and in the underground, from the tallest mountain to the deepest sea, this great big world is my family. Everything that lived here once before, and everything to come will find an open door.
And here we are back on the air. I'm Elaine Schroeder, and in the studio with me is Nancy Seamont, a well-known and well-loved educator and counselor at the Downtown High School. And, Nancy, it's been wonderful having you on the air, and I know both of us share the notion of parenting takes a lot of time. And years ago, one of my mentors, a wise old child development specialist, said, when it comes to parenting, love is spelled T-I-M-E. So what are your thoughts on parents getting the time?
That wise old friend of yours was right on. I guess I would say my final thoughts would be on the power of play. Playing with our kids extends through high school, you know, through their whole lives. We have to be able to see the silly, realize that they have a developing brain. They sometimes do things and they themselves can say, what was I thinking? So I guess my final thoughts would be, in terms of forming relationships with kids, have fun, play, don't take everything so serious. Take the right things serious.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Thank you. And thank you to all our listeners for tuning in to K2. I'll be hosting our next edition of Dr. E on Monday evening, May 9th at 7 p.m., when I'll be interviewing Nancy Simpson, a skilled Juno therapist who'll talk about her work with clients who've experienced emotional and physical trauma. Tonight, thank you, Nancy Seamont, for being here. Especially thank you for your insights and your compassionate work with Juno teenagers and their families. And John and Dolly Kramers, I'd like to thank you for your technical support this evening. They beautifully multitask, including finding rare and unusual CDs so we could play this evening.